What do I know?
Well, you seem to know it a hell of a lot. So we're just trying to, you know, kind of get to the root of what you know.
It's only just fit together. It's too hard. People are so freaking bent, you know. They can't put that together.
Absolutely.
Cow, then another dead cow, then dead cow. I mean, there was 30 dead cows there. Then when I was north of Corona, and here comes this A7, you know, just coming down and buzzing us and everything. And I looked up, I said, Linda, how can this be happening to us? You know, why? And he said, John, you'll never know what it's like to see your first alien. It would have been, exposed the entire cover-up.
We were ushered into John's amazing study. He's got televisions all over the wall. He's got photos of airplanes, celebrities, his family, and
here we see a photograph of Area 51. This is a real photograph, high-resolution photograph. It's about 4 feet long. amazing picture taken from what I believe was called Freedom Ridge. This has now been closed to public access, but somebody took a lot of care taking this incredible photo. And this is something that really captivated my interest. It's the F-19, which is supposed not to exist. John insists that this is flown covertly by the Navy.
And what would seem to be planes he loves and planes he's flown. He's a very mysterious man. He has so many top secret contacts, you don't really know what he's flown and what he's actually just put on the wall because he loves the look of it.
Here's a picture of the moon. It's about 3 foot by 2 foot. It's very high resolution, and in John's own words, this is before it was airbrushed by NASA. And here, what happened as soon as we sat down was that John immediately started talking about not the 3 astronauts that were killed in the fire on the Apollo 1 launch pad in January 27th, 1967, but 4 astronauts. There's a 4th astronaut whose existence has never been admitted by NASA. The whole thing has been covered up for very specific reasons, and here is John to tell his story.
It's the best kept secret. I mean, it is. Now, figure all those guys in Mission Control. They were all, like, between 25 and 35. So
right.
It's been 40 years. So okay. Now they're between 65 and 35. There's some of them still living.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know whether they keep up to what's going on.
But, so you're saying they knew what happened?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were all there. They heard, I don't know if you've seen my stuff on the internet about
yeah.
what I assume that Gus Grissom said. You know, he said, okay, you assholes, kill us, we're dead, this is a fire that could have been prevented, and you didn't do it. You know, he had a long time to say that. And all this stuff, I have all the Apollo records, all the, you know, the stuff, the accident stuff. And a lot of things happened. And the emails that I've gotten from Clark on it, you know, are very circumspect. He's very careful about what he says. And but in my mind, he's confirmed totally what happened without
wow.
saying so in so many words. And basically what I asked him was what was the name of the 4th astronaut, and he never gave it to me. But I found out from other sources who it was. So, anybody,
are you at liberty to say?
No. And the reason is because I want somebody to come to me and say, I know who it was, and then say the name.
Wow, cool. So if we think we know, we could email you maybe?
Absolutely. Just give me your last name and I'll tell you what it's true. So what's so interesting about the reason they couldn't talk about the 4th astronaut, and of course when the fire happened, NSA cordoned off everything for 45 minutes while they took that body out, and then they opened it up, and then that's when the official investigation started. You read through the all the scenarios, you can see where that 45 minutes fit into there, where they took that body out. Now the reason they didn't want anybody to know about the body is because he was part of the secret astronaut corps. So now if anybody would have found out that body, they went, well, who was it? What was his name? Well, what did he do? Well, how come he isn't listed here? It would have been exposed the entire cover-up. So that's why they couldn't let
it go. So that secret astronaut corps
is a huge secret. And I interviewed Gary McKinnon, and he tapped into
Gary's
that.
Gary's telling us all about it. I don't know why people don't put that together.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Gary's got the whole story there. It was so interesting that Gary should come out at the same time that I uncovered the fourth astronaut.
Oh, really? The same time?
Well, it was the same time frame, like plus or minus a couple of months.
Wow.
So that's Gary, fabulous. Boy, I'd sure like to talk with that guy, but he talks about, you know, the non-terrestrial officers, and
that's right.
I mean, the story just fits together. It's too hard. People are so friggin' dense, you know, they can't put that together.
Absolutely. So we also want to talk a little bit about Dulcie and what you know about Dulcie. And I know that people are saying, you know, the Benowitz story, what just didn't happen, and I know that you've confirmed that it did. That Benowitz was correct.
He was, and I got into that when I first got into this UFO deal. I ended up in Crestone, Colorado with Linda Howe, and God, there was like 10 of us there, and somebody had donated a condo in Crestone that had been used by the Aspen Institute for their, you know, get-togethers and studies. And we met, and it was 3 or 4 days there, and we talked about, you know, what should go on, and what should we do, and about the state of ufology and, you know, how each one can contribute. And I ended up leaving there and driving with Linda. And, while we were there, Tom Adams, you know who Tom is?
No.
He was one of the chargers on weird UFO stuff, mutilations,
okay.
All that stuff in 1987, 88, 89. I don't have it. He ran put out that flyer called Stigmata. It was really interesting stuff. So anyway, he handed me a note. He said, John's, somebody called me from Las Vegas, and you might want to follow this up because I can't do it. And it was a handwritten note about a place called Dulcie, and the person knew somebody that worked there and talked about, you know, something about Dulcie. And the thing I remember about the note was it says, and hallway, tiled hallways that went on forever. And boy, this captivated my imagination. So anyway, I go with Linda Howe. We go down to Albuquerque. We look up Ernie Edwards. We talk with Ernie Edwards.
Is he still alive, by the way?
You know, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But he was so forthright and to me, so honest. He said he believed Benowitz. You know, we talked about during that time the Albuquerque radar, FAA radar was shut down for a long period. And I said, what do you think happened? He said, I think they brought a black ship through there and they didn't want it on radar. I said, how can you, a colonel, an active colonel in the Air Force, say something like that? He said, that's what I believe. So anyway, and then we talked about all kinds of stuff. And then Linda and I went down to, drove down to Roswell, and that was an interesting trip. We're driving down to Roswell, and we're about 10 miles north of Corona, and here comes this A7, you know, just coming down at business and everything. And I looked up, I said, Linda, how can this be happening to us? You know, I know those A7s, you know, they're part of the F-117A stealth fighters, why not Potomac. Anyway, we turn off Corona and we go over this little road, it's then a dirt road, over towards the main road that came down from the highway to Roswell. We get just before the turnoff that goes down to Mac Brazel's ranch. And we're bumping along, and here's one dead cow, then another dead cow, then another dead cow. I mean, there was 30 dead cows there. So we go over to the dead cows, and there's no obvious sign of the mutilations. And so we go on the road down towards Matt Bradlow, what used to be his ranch. We talked to the farmer there, and he said, oh, yeah, he said, we don't know what's happened. Or he said, we contacted the state veterinary stuff, and it's this particular disease, whatever it was. Anyway, later Linda contacted somebody, found out that no, it could have been that disease, but because there would have been a 50-mile cord around there. So that was just one of those little interesting things. So then we went down, we talked with Clifford Stone, who I know.
Oh, do you?
And then I went back up.
So Clifford Stone, does he know about the Dulcie situation as well?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Clifford, yeah, he knows everything. Uh-huh. So then I went up, and I'm thinking that all I trying to remember whether I went and stayed at Ben's Lewis's house before this happened or after, but at some point, I went and spent 2 days in his house with him and his wife, listened to his story, spent a lot of time with him, looked over, selected all of his pictures, all the stuff showing the flying saucers taken off from the Manzana weapon storage area and landing, you know. They were great big by Tim Prince. A guy named Chris Lambright had them last that I knew. I was going to steal them from Chris, but I gave them back to him. And I have one or two 4x5s of those.
Oh, do you?
Anyway, and then I left Benowitz, and he gave me the big X-ray of the little thing that the girl had in her neck.
Uh-huh.
And that I gave to Ron Revere, and I don't know what he ever did with it. But anyway, I end up in Dulce, call up Gabe Valdez, say, I'm here. And he says, yeah. He says, look, I've got patrol tonight between 10 o'clock and 6 in the morning. You want to go with me? I said, yeah. So he comes over, and I say, I'm John Lear. He says, I know who you are. I remember you were here 20 years ago in a Learjet. And I said, really? He said, yeah, you brought in steaks for Dean Martin and his girlfriend. And I remember, yeah, well, I was flying charter. And he jogged my memory. I had been chartered out of Van Nuys to bring in fresh steaks and Dean Martin's girlfriend to a movie that he was filming in Dulce. And Gabe remembered me from that.
That's amazing.
So we got in his car, and it was the most interesting evening, 8 hours. We would all wind around these little roads. It was black as heck, you know. We talked about all Banowitz, Bernie Edwards. What's the guy's name? Doty, Moore, the whole thing. And it was just really an interesting drive. And we stopped, and we had some green chili at these little Mexican places. It was a fascinating evening. Anyway, I got some sleep the next day, and then I had this rented car, and I tried to go up the Arcelor Mesa, because what I wanted to do was see the spot where the nuclear craft had crashed, or the Benowitz said it crashed.
Mm-hmm.
Because Gabe said, you know, as far as I know, it did. He said there's obvious, you can see the tree that it hit. You know, we found a government pen up there. You know, there's all kinds of evidence that it happened. But it was in the winter, and I had this two-wheel drive, and I tried to go up this back road up the Mesa, and I nearly went off into the canyon. So I never got up there. But,
so that wasn't like guarded at that time?
No, I don't think it is today.
Oh, really?
I don't know.
That's interesting.
I can show you the place where I went to go up there. But anyway, I get back to Vegas. I make contact with a person, and this person tells me the whole thing about is his name Costello? What was his last name? The guy that worked at Dulce?
Yeah, that sounds right.
There's Costello and there's Schneider. Yeah, we've come out of a public record.
And we talked for days, weeks, months. And this person gave me pencil drawings of what that either she had seen in the video or Costello had described to her. Those ended up in were the Dulce papers. Those were my drawings. As I mentioned on some thread the other day, the Dulce papers text is posted and on the internet, and that's what I typed from what the person who knew Costello told. That's my typewriter. That typewriter's out in the garage. It's an IBM, what they call executive, and they have proportional spacing.
Right.
And, you know, those are my drawings. I made ink drawings of the pencil drawings. I still have the pencil drawings.
Uh-huh.
I think the ink drawings I gave to Val. I haven't seen them around, but they may be around. I don't know. I have so many files I have, you know, out in the garage. You know, they just, you know, I have some legal file, four-door cabinets here, two or three, just full of this stuff. You know?
Now, why do you think you're left alone? Why do you think you know so much, number one, and why do you think that the government leaves you alone?
They don't bother anybody with secondhand.
Exactly.
They got Phil because he was there. I will forever rue the day of not giving Phil Schneider, you know, enough attention, because he's right here. He sat right here, told me his story, and it's not that I didn't believe it. It's that, you know, yeah, well, you know, maybe, you know, and it's too bad because he did have the story. I wish I would have given him more time than I did. And that happened with another person. I'll remember in just a second. Another person that I didn't give that much attention to. He came here, years ago and told me all that stuff. And there's a guy I didn't believe until later. What's his name up there, the S4 guy?
Talking about Dan?
Dan. I sat here and I watched two or three hours of the tapes, and I thought, that guy's been there. Nobody could make that stuff up. Now, the Dan Burry story is simple, but it's complex. He was there. He did work there. I listened to George Knapp the other day, and I read his stuff on ATS, and he is so down on Dan Burry. It's unfortunate.
Did you see my interview with Dan? I just did an interview with him. It's posted right now. You should take a look at it. It's actually almost 2.5 hours of intense testimony.
Him describe Area 51 and S4. No question in my mind was there.
Right.
But now there's something that's happening to Dan and something they're doing with him, and it all fits into Project Sherpo.
You think so?
I think that it's a big, long-range disinformation program. But the bottom line is, Burrish was up there. He worked up there, and it's really interesting. It's two bad people, when they look on these stories, it's either right or it's wrong.
Right.
They can't know that there's some parts that are correct,
exactly.
Some parts that are disinformation. They want it, left or right, bad or good, It's too bad. George Knapp, I've known him for years, and he's always, he's got some good ideas. I mean, he's done some tremendous work, but always seems to be about 3 years behind me, it takes a while to understand this, to get into this stuff,
Well, how did you get into research? Because, you were a pilot, you had a lot of other things going on, but what was the trigger that really got you deep into this stuff?
I said that on the internet. I told them what happened. I was across town. A friend of mine, his name was Al Newell. We were shooting buddies together. In those days, IPSC was a big thing, International Practical Shooting Congress. And we spent a lot of time together. And I was over at his house, and there was a book on the table, and it was called Missing Time by Bud Hopkins. And I picked this thing up, and God, this is kind of interesting because, I'd always been interested in saucers, but not that much. As it turns out, my dad was right here.
Really?
My mom had a crush on Hoyt Vandenberg, one of the MJ-12s. He was in the house over there. So was Jimmy Doolittle. Dad was on the board of the Lovelace Clinic. Randy Lovelace, was a surgeon in Wright-Patterson when the Roswell thing happened. They sent him to Albuquerque, where he's from, to form to do the Lovelace Institute. The Lovelace Institute was where they, did the autopsies of the bodies. I mean, the whole group was, my dad, Jimmy Doolittle,
Wirt
Vandenberg, all those guys were together.
Is your dad still alive?
No, he died in 1978. He used to talk about this all the time, but not in too much detail.
Uh-huh.
He went down to Bogota in 1953 and made an announcement that he thought UFOs were real and made a thing. And of course, MJ-12 came down and Bill, you can't say this stuff. He said, well, I didn't tell him anything more than anybody else knew. Yeah, but Bill, you can't do it. Now, apparently he was into the anti-gravity stuff. There's a video floating around, 3 minutes on the internet, that shows my dad giving a lecture with my mom standing behind him with pictures of saucers on the blackboard at the Bonson Institute to a group of scientists. There's also more in that video that shows scientists working on balsa wood and tissue things of UFOs doing I don't know what, but there's a calendar. And it's obviously somebody who's trying to tell us something at the calendar, and the X date, the days are marked off. And it's obvious to whoever made this videotape is telling us that it was important, something important was being developed or had to be developed. So
you saw this book on this table of your friend.
Oh, but Missing Time. So I picked it up, and I read it, and I was just absolutely, it just hit me. This stuff is real. It's real. It's going on right now. So, and I'm thinking this is like 85 or something. At the exact same time, we had a reunion of Southeast Asia pilots here in Las Vegas, and I ran into one of the Ravens. You know who the Ravens were, the sheep guy that flew in Laos. Greg Wilson was a Raven, and got to talk to him. Hey, where you been? You know, he said, oh, I was at Bentwaters. They had Bentwaters.
Oh, wow.
Were you there in 1980? He said, yeah. I said, I was there. He said, I didn't see it land, but I know the guys who did. I said, you mean it's real? He said, yeah, John, it's real. So then at the exact same time, I ended up, I was based in New York with this airline, and I called Bud Hopkins, and I said, I'd like to talk to you. Okay, so I came back from a trip in Europe. It was crazy. I had my big suitcase and my flight bag and something else, and instead of going to the apartment I lived at and dropping it off, I went to Bud's house. So when I ring the doorbell, he opens it up. He says, John Lear? And I said, yeah. He says, what's all that? He was afraid I was going to come in and move in with him. So anyway, I spent the evening with him, and he did a regression. He said, you can't, you know, be this interested and not be involved, you know.
Right.
And we didn't find anything. But anyway, that started my friendship with Bud Hopkins, and all this, it all happened at the same time. Those were crazy years.
So, you know, Bill Cooper, I mean, you seem to have known just about everybody who was anybody at the time.
Yeah, I was working Parent at the time. Jim Spicer ran Parent. I put my hypothesis on Paranet. Then Bill Cooper called. He said, I can vouch for, and I forget what he said, 50% or 100% of what John Lear says. And so then I invited Bill Cooper up. He came up. We, you know, talked. He told me at those times, Bill was totally sane and rational.
Mm-hmm.
He told me that he was the guy at Pearl Harbor who set up the camera and got the documents out of the safe for the briefings of the high-level Navy guys who go through. 5 years later, he's an intelligence officer, you know, giving the briefing himself. He wasn't. He was just the guy in the office that set up the projector, and he did have the key to the safe, and he did read all that stuff. But later, he got what we call UFO disease. And UFO disease is something that we get that people were just so in demand as speakers, you know, and we've already told whatever we know, so now we got to make up a little more to keep the interest being, in demand like that. It's addictive, so you make up a little more, and that's called UFO disease, and that's what happened to Bill. He started making stuff up. About this time, Bob, I met Bob here the summer of 1988.
Bob Lazar.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sat right there with Gene Huff, and Gene Huff had come over. Gene Huff had called me, and he said, hey, can I get a copy of your UFO stuff? And I said, Gene, I'm out of it. My wife's, you know, going nuts. I said, I've just dropped everything. He says, well, in case you ever get her, you know, need a appraisal on your house, maybe we could work a deal out. I said, you're an appraiser? And at that time, I needed an appraisal to get a second because I'm totally out of money. He said, yeah. I said, oh, well, listen, I'll give you all my stuff if you'll appraise my house. And from that day on, he has always held that against me because he had no idea how big this place was. And he claims he got the short end of the deal. But when he came over, the guy that was holding the measuring tape was Bob Lazar. And so Bob brought over his resume, and he handed it to me. And that's when I saw, you know, the degree from MIT and the degree from Caltech.
Mm-hmm.
But all that stuff, along with Benowitz's, some of his photos were stolen.
Out of your house?
Yeah, out of here. I mean, they spent, who knows how much time they spent in this office digging stuff out of my file.
Wow.
All kinds of stuff was missing, as was at Bob's house, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the people we knew at, it wasn't called Sprint, but the telephone company that, you know, found Bob's house was wired. This house was wired.
Do you comb your house for bugs and things like that, or just don't bother anymore?
No, I don't bother. But the telephone guy here was Centel, and used to do a lot of switching around of phones for my teenage daughters. So one day he comes in about this time that I'm telling you about, and he says, John, your phone's tapped. And I said, yeah, no kidding. He said, you know, I'd like to find out where it is tapped. And I said, hey, be my guest. So he comes back about a half an hour later. He says it's not down Monroe or Hollywood or Bonanza. He said it's farther than that. And he said, I'm going to find out. I said, you know, you don't have to. I said, I know it's tapped. I said, don't worry about it. He said, no, I'd like to find out. So he comes back the next day. John, your phone is tapped at the mainframe. He said, I went to my boss and told him about it. He said, if you want to keep your job, you keep your mouth shut.
Wow.
He said, so I'm keeping my mouth shut, but I'm telling you, it's tapped at the mainframe, and they don't have the paperwork. He said, I look for the paperwork to authorize a tap like that. He said, they don't have it. So, anyway, I meet Bob. We talk. He thinks me and Gene are totally nuts. He said he worked at Los Alamos. He said if there had been anything about UFOs, he would have known. He said, you guys are crazy. And he sat there rolling his eyes at all the stuff we were talking about. So, over the next few months, we started giving him information. And one of the things we gave him was where we thought the alien was held at
S4.
Los Alamos. Was YY-2. And it turns out, and we told him some other stuff, and I figured out what it was, but there were three things we told him, and he confirmed all three things. And he didn't confirm there was an alien at YY-2, but he did confirm it was a mail stop, and it was absolutely secret. I mean, one of the biggest secrets. So he decided to see if he could get a job up at Area 51. So he called Dr. Teller. And I thought I was there for the phone call. I may not have been. I may have been there when Dr. Teller called him back. But I remember Dr. Teller saying, do you want to work here at Livermore or do you want to work in Las Vegas? And Bob says, I want to work at Area 51. And Teller said, let me see what I can do. So then that was like in November of 88. And I remember Bob going for interviews at EG&G, and he told us exactly what they asked at the interviews, and it was very, very technical, and he said he did really good at all of it, because he really knew what the thought, and he was really proud of himself. And he said the second interview, the first question was, what's your relationship with John Lear, and what do you know about him? And Bob said, was talking to me, he said, I told him that I do know John Lear. I go over to his house. I think he sticks his nose in places where it doesn't belong. He said, what I didn't tell him is I also like to stick my nose in places it doesn't belong. So then the next thing I know is, I think I say December 6th. It could have been before or after, I remember, but this table wasn't here. There was two chairs. There he came in. It was at night. It was about 7 or 8 o'clock, and he sat down. I was writing checks, and he said, John, I saw a disc today. And I looked up, and he said, what? He said, I saw a disc today. I said, there's Rars. He said, there's. I said, you went to Area 51. He said, yeah. I said, what are you doing here? I said, you know, why did you find out what's going on and then tell me about it? He says, no. He says, you've taken so much crap over this thing. I'm telling you, I saw it. It's all real. So we spent, you know, a couple hours here, and he said, I will answer your questions. I can't volunteer information. He made me ask the question. Mm-hmm. And then we went outside, stood outside, looked up at the stars. I said, well, if I want to go to Zeta Reticulae, do I go, which way do I go? He said, this way. And he was saying how they take off and he had an explanation for why you have to go to the right first or this way, whatever it was. Anyway, but that went on for several months, and he came over every, you know, whenever he got back and tell me what he saw. One night he comes in, sits down, and after the first night, we didn't talk in here anymore. And I forget what the trigger was, but we didn't discuss anything. So he's sitting there like this, and, you know, giving the high sight. So we walked out that door, out by the pool, and out by the stable. And as we walked by, Marilee, who was always suspicious of everything, says, where are you guys going? And I think, we're just going to go out in the back and talk. And so we went out in the back alleyway there, and I said, what? And he said, John, you will never know what it's like to see your first alien. I said, you saw him? He was alive? He said, yep. And he told me the circumstances, and he was being led down a corridor and has four guards on each side. I have the drawing here that he, when he told me that, of what he said. He said there was a door. He said it had a regular square window about 12 inches by 12 inches with the wire going through. And inside he saw the back of the gray, standing with the back towards him and talking to two scientists who were looking down like this, and they had their lab coat. And so that was just... and the story going on.
You know, he was sort of... His house was trashed. You know, he basically left the government's employ. I mean,
okay, so,
he was on the run, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, we go on. Then it becomes, he's going back and forth up there. And March 21st, I'm over at his house, and he's designing a doggy death ray. And a doggy death ray is because the dog, Marilee's dogs, are getting in our flowers. And he's going to design a little amplifier with a high-pitched sound, which would keep him out of there. And it's Tuesday the 21st, and I remember watching TV, and it was the day they sent a missile from a boat, and it did loop-de-loops. And Bob said, they're going to test fly tomorrow night, do you want to go see? And I said, yeah, but how where can we go? He said, I know a back road to the test site without getting on illegal property, you know, still on BLM, we can see it. I said, great. So the next day, he and Jane... And his wife, Jackie, I think there was four of us, get a my motor home in the front here. And this was March 22nd. We drive up to Alamo and turn off the road to Rachel. And we're almost up that hillway, and the transmission went out. So, and it's at night, and he said, well, I got to be there at sunset because that's when they test fly. So Gene Huff hitchhiked from where we were stuck back down to Ash Springs, got a couple of cans of transmission oil, brought them back up, we poured them in, and then we continued out. So we got out there just a little after dark, and we went down the back road into Groom Lake, and we went down maybe halfway, and we pulled in this little area, and I took out the telescope, set it up, Bob had the video camera, set it up, and we started looking, and then we saw it. It was like about 9 o'clock. A light comes up and starts going this way and that way and everything. And I'm trying to get this scope, you know, and it's
wow.
eight inch diameter lens focused on the UFO. And of course, you know, there's no way. I mean, the thing is, you know, it's too big and it's too cumbersome. But anyway, at one point, the saucer stopped and I got it nailed in. And I said, I got it. And that's when I said it was a flying saucer. It was about, maybe 30 to 35, maybe 40, 45 degrees angle. It was yellow and radiating something off it. And I said, I see it. And I said, Gene, quick, take a look. And so as I stepped away, my foot hooked the tripod. And it got out of it, so Gene didn't get to see it. What it was doing, it was coming, it was making a descent behind the mountain.
Beautiful.
So then, I'll show you if we have time here. I have a tape that's labeled March 22nd, and we videotaped all that was going on. Unfortunately, the videotape was sitting on the bumper while all this was going on. But we videotaped afterwards, you know, the conversation about, you know, seeing it. Anyway, the next Wednesday night. They always test it on Wednesday nights and at sunset because they determined that was the time of least traffic on that road that people could accidentally see the saucer. So the next night was March 29th, and I was on a trip with American Trans Air in Cleveland, and that was when I called Bob Tuesday night, and I said, you know, I'm in Cleveland, I won't be able to, I said, what are you guys doing? He said, we're going fishing. And I said, oh, cool, I wish I could go. That was the night he took George Knapp and Jim Taliani. Jim Taliani worked at Tonopah Test Range, and that's the week after is when he got fired, because when this tape got out that George Knapp shot, they could hear Jim's voice saying, oh, neat, and they called him in, you know, and said, you're it. It may not have been the next week, but it was after that. Then the third Wednesday was April 6th, and that was when me, Bob, Gene, Bob's wife, and her sister rented a car because the motorhome was out and something else was out. We actually had to rent a car and go up there, and that's when we had the Geiger counter and all the video stuff and everything in the trunk. Went up there, got all ready. We're driving in. I said, come on, we don't need to go any farther. Let's stop here. No, no, let's get closer, closer. And Bob's wife's sister is driving. And that's when we saw, you know, I said one time it was four cars. Maybe it was two, but whatever. There was headlights in front of us. And I said, we got to get out of here. So I told, I forget what her name is, turn around carefully because we're in dust, you know, in sand here, and we don't want to get caught. So turned around, and we started, you know, hauling ass out of there. And when we, it was obviously we weren't going to get to the highway before they caught us, so we stopped. Bob says, look, I can't afford to get caught. I'm taking my gun. He had a 9mm, and I'm going out in the desert. And he said, when they leave, I'll come back. So we stopped. He goes out in the desert. I take the telescope, start setting it up, and they skid to a stop. And they're all standing around there with the machine gun, their port arms. And actually, I ran up to the vehicle, and I put my hands on the top of it. What are you guys doing here? What's going on? And they said, we need to see my ID. And I said, yeah, I don't understand. What are you guys chasing us in the desert for? And they said, well, what are you running for? And so things calmed down. We showed our driver's license. They said, you know, they made some calls. They said, look, we can't kick you out of here because it's BLM land. But we make it awful uncomfortable if you stick around here. So, you know, you make your own choice. So they left. We waited about 15 minutes. The trunk was open because I had gotten a telescope out. So we were kind of blinded. We had no idea that all these guys did was go about 100 yards down the road, turn around, set up all their cameras and parabolic recording equipment, and they're recording everything that comes out and goes on. Bob comes out of the desert with his 9mm. He says, you know, it's a good thing they didn't make false moves. I would have blasted them on his mother ring. So we talk for about 15 minutes and then pack everything up and, you know, go out. We hit the highway. There's Lincoln County Sheriff. Woo, all the sirens, red lights, everything. Get us out, you know, hands up, hands against the car. It's been about, you know, 15, 20 minutes. I made the comment that Bob will never, ever forgive me for when the sheriff says, I'll need to see his licenses. And I said, mine's in the trunk. Of course, everything was in the trunk, including the gun, the Geiger counter, all the video equipment and everything. We never let him in the trunk. He said, all I know is, why are there five people in this car now? And at the test site, there were only four. And where's the gun? That's all I want to know. And we spent a good hour hemming and hawing. And at the end of the hour, he gets a call and he says, okay, his name is Lafrenay, Sheriff Lafrenay. He said, I don't know why I've been told to do this, but I've been told to let you guys go. Now, it doesn't make any sense to me, but those are my orders. So he said, I want you to get in that car, and I don't want to see you ever around here again. So we left, driving into town. Now it's, you know, like 11 or 12 o'clock. We discussed, you know, what was going on. And the next day, Bob gets a call from his boss, and I'm trying to remember what his name is. He says, Bob, don't go out to the airport. I'm going to pick you up. And I drove Bob up to Indian Springs, and which is the head of all the test sites. And they literally took him out of the car with a gun in his ear, and they took him in there and said, Bob, now, when we gave you clearance and told you the secret, it didn't mean you were supposed to tell all your friends about the flying saucers. Now, do you want to work here or not? And Bob was noncommittal. They had brought the guards that had caught us or, you know, talked to us down to, you know, prove that, you know, that we were there. And Bob was noncommittal. And a few days later, he said, I'm not going back to work there. And we said, why? And he said, because the last time I went on that 737, he said, I could remember going up the boarding ramp.
And I remember
coming back down the boarding ramp, but I cannot remember anything that went on after that or between that. And he said, I don't want to work under those conditions. I'd rather not work under those conditions.
Wow.
Even, you know, he said, I know what's going on, and it's great. He said, but I don't want to work under those circumstances. So that's why I didn't come back.
Okay, well, that's fabulous stuff. I have a question. We met a guy that said underground in Area 51 that they, I don't know if the guy was like whacked out or what, but he said they have piles of like cocaine and they're drugging people, you know, to get them to work there, basically. They fly them in, they give them drugs, they give them women. Do you know anything about that?
No, but I have every reason to believe that's true. I mean, the underground facilities up at Area 51 are so enormous. They're so big. They stretch on forever. They have many levels. I have a friend of mine at the gold mine I operate, the people that originally ran that mine, one of the guys is in jail up at Winnemucca. And one of the guys that's in there is a security guard. And he tells them, and the reason that security guard at Area 51 is in there is because he started to talk, and he's in there for life. But he tells the guys in there,
what
can they do to him now? And he said, yeah, it goes on forever. You know, I said, there's plenty of stuff on the ground. There's no doubt in my mind. See the stuff on Area 51. Oh, I know guys that work there, and they said there's no underground. Of course, because, you know, there's... maybe 1,900 people who work above ground there. There's no reason for them. When you work at Area 51, they don't say, give you a briefing, and they say, now, you know, don't tell anybody about the aliens we got up here. They don't do anything. They're guys that, you know, work on, you know, airplanes and are mechanics. They have no reason to know that stuff. Sure. Security doesn't work that way.
I mean, is it your understanding that Benowitz was basically messed with through mind control?
Benowitz was onto some very good information, real information. He's the one that discovered Dulce. He's the one that knew about the black ship that crashed on Archuleta Mesa. He's the one that knew about the stuff in the Manzano. Doty was sent to disinform him along with Bill Moore to make him look like an idiot.
And you knew Bill Moore, right? Is that right?
Yeah, Moore. You know, that guy.
Because Bill Moore has kind of gone black. I mean, he's not out in public really right now. I guess he was messed with a lot. But he knows a lot as well, wouldn't you say?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, at this point. What about Serpo? So I understand on ATS you basically said Serpo is disinfo in general, but that, yes, you know, we obviously sent astronauts.
That we did send a team. They went to Zeta Reticuli. There's three of them. You know, that could be disinformation. Who knows? Maybe there was five, you know.
Right.
But the problem with Serpo, as we're seeing now, and with Burrish, is that there's male and females. That's not right.
What do you mean, males and females?
From Zeta Reticuli.
You mean the aliens are male and female?
There are male and females.
Are you saying there aren't?
No. They're cybernetic organisms. The guys who made those guys, which they call the J-Rod or the Grays or whatever, those guys are just cybernetic organisms. They come here. Their job is to see that this farm, I used to call it an experiment. It's not an experiment. It's a farm. It's a soul farm. Things are going along fine. I used to think it was evil. It's not. We're just developing.
Right.
And those guys, the Grays, are just here doing the monitoring work, seeing that everything's going okay. They pick up kids when they're 3 to 4. They pick them up when they're 7 to 8. And then once they're 13, be sure that everything's going okay. And that's all their job.
Genetic manipulation, in other words, upgrading the race.
And right now we're arrogant, murderous, thieves, you know, and we learn to grow out of it. And when we learn to grow out of that, we'll be able to go and play with everybody else in the universe, which is, you know, a great big wonderful place.
So where do you get your certainty from?
My what?
Your certainty about what you know. You know what I mean? Is it because you've talked to so many people who've been in deep?
Yeah.
Yeah. But have you yourself had any ET interactions that you know of?
Probably, but I don't have the slightest memory.
Okay.
The only thing, you know, that ever happened was when I was 9 or 10 years old, I used to go down to, on Saturday mornings, to Brownie Brown's dance studio where I took tumbling, ballet, and tap dancing. It would end at 12. I'd walk outside the door to Ocean Park Boulevard, get on the bus, and go back to my house on 222 14th Street, which is about 30 minutes. So one day, I get on the bus after dancing school, and I get to where I'm getting off at my house 30 minutes later, and I remember stepping off down the stepway on the bus, looking up at the driver, and I was so shocked. I said, I couldn't say anything for a minute. And then I said, didn't I just take this bus home? And he looked at me with the strangest thing. And it was just, it's gone. Time. I mean, who knows where it went, you know.
How much time was that?
Probably, you know, who knows, maybe. I don't remember being conscious of, you know, 1 hour, 2 hours, but it had to be, you know, an hour or so.
Do you feel that the grays are malevolent?
No.
Okay. And are you aware that we are basically kind of building a shield around the planet to bounce off, you know, basically have a war with aliens and that sort of thing?
It's hilarious. I mean, our government is so arrogant, you know. They know so little. You know, here they are, they think they're going to build a shield against, you know, the Greys or whoever. There may be some kind of a war going on, but the basic theme, basically what Earth is all about, is the development of the soul. Mm-hmm. There's billions of Earths in the universe. Billions of them. Just like Earth, in various stages of development. Some of them are not as advanced as we are, some of them are more advanced. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's all about the soul and getting a bigger, not being such murderous, arrogant, you know, thieves and, you know, going on. We have to develop. The sun is not a series of thermonuclear explosions. The sun is an electromagnetic sphere. And what it does is it reacts with the electromagnetics of the certain planets, all the planets in the solar system, which enables them to have atmospheres and environments just like Earth. Mercury is not hot enough to melt lead. It's just like Earth. Neptune is not a big gas giant. It's just like Earth. The only big gas giant in our solar system is NASA. I'm just talking about what they're trying to feed us now on Project Zero.
Okay.
And the reason is, I believe, that there's no way the government can hide any more of the Greys. They have to come up with a story.
Right.
So since they don't know who they are or what they're doing, they just want to say, yeah, they're from Zeta Reticuli. Yeah, we've been there. Yeah, it's a mom-and-pop deal. They play soccer. We played soccer with them. Yeah, it's no big deal.
Yeah, except that they were doing genetic engineering, and they took the parts of one astronaut and the body parts and were cloning him. That's part of the Serpo story as well.
I didn't read
Yeah, well, a lot of people miss that. Because they're actually...
Which astronaut?
One of the astronauts that died on Serpo.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Was basically found to be cloned.
Yeah.
And supposedly they almost started a war over finding that they couldn't, you know, do last rites on their body, the body of their fellow astronaut. I mean, it's a great story, but who knows if it's true.
And I may be wrong. I don't believe it. It's disinformation.
But we've been to Zeta Reticuli. I mean, so the root of the story is actually true. I mean, as far as you're concerned, or maybe because of what your contacts are telling you. Because there are some pretty deep in people.
I haven't seen, it's the day is 90 Earth hours long. I haven't seen that information come up.
Okay.
It's the fourth planet from Zeta Reticuli 2. So if you're standing on Reticulum 4, you're going to see both suns, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2.
Wow. Yeah, because apparently there are pictures of some things like that.
Great.
Now, are you saying that you don't believe there are pictures, or are you laughing
there could be.
Because there could be?
Could be.
Okay.
And what do I know?
Well, you seem to know it a hell of a lot. So we're just trying to, kind of get to the root of what you know.
Yeah.
What about Bobby Ray Inman? You know what his involvement is?
Oh, he's been involved in MJ-12. Remember who Bob Exler was? Bob Exler was really a neat guy. I mean, he charged into this with me. I mean, he stood right there in that door and saw some kind of a beam come out of this place back here. We know, or I believe, that this whole mountain is combed with,
That's quite a mountain you have behind you.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
We believe it's all, there's, all kinds of bases, or whatever they call them, inside the
Sure.
Thing.
It looks like it could.
Exler saw that. Exler was the guy, and if you haven't read this story or heard it, you got to read it. where he's back east someday. And I went with him, drove around for hours with him when I was flying cargo. I'd get out of my airplane at 10 o'clock at night, and we'd drive until 6 in the morning. We did all kinds of crazy things. But Bob one day walked into EG&G and says, how do I get into the saucer program or something like that? And
but what's Bobby Ray Inman got to do with that?
Okay, so that's what led us to this. So Bob Exler finds Bobby Ray Inman at some, you know, some public attendance, goes up to him and says, how do I get judge in MJ-12? And Inman looks at him and says, let me see if I can help you. And so that started the interaction between Bob Exler and Bobby Ray Inman.
That's why was Bobby Ray Inman so helpful? Is he like
to Exler?
Yeah, I mean, is he like a sort of a fan of Disclosure? Would you say
it's yeah? There's always been part of MJ-12, you know, that wants to disclose, you know, and they always get up to the threshold where they think, well, let's tell the public something, you know,
and, right.
Then they always back away, and I don't
exactly.
Know why, I don't know why they always back away.
Okay, I better get ready for this game.
Alright. Really fabulous. I mean, we want to thank you.
Okay,
you're
glad you asked the right questions. I was afraid of what direction you were going to take, but, you know, I'm just telling the story of what happened to me, what I believe. That doesn't mean I'm right, you know.
Sure.
That just means what I believe.
Thank you so much.
Well, oh, 0.98.
Yeah.
I never heard so much bullshit in my entire life. I mean, that is just, if you'll excuse the expression, crap. I mean, it's not going to happen. It didn't happen. It won't happen.
Why well, there? Are you familiar with Hal Pudoff?
Sure. Fantastic work at Stanford and university. And
well, he's involved in something to do with zero
that's
point, though.
Deal. And he keeps telling, you know, sending all this stuff on zero point energy.
And you just don't believe it.
No. It's a scam.
You think so? Are you? You think it's a scam because scientifically you think it's a scam, or because people have told you, your contacts are saying it's
no.
a scam?
I think it's, and I'll take the blame if it's not. I think it's a scam.
Huh. What about 2012? You think that's a scam?
Yes. We're continually in wars. Continually the world's going to end. It's to keep us all riled up and worried and everything. You know, all of us just want to go home. We just want to make a living and go home and be with our family and kids. That's all we want to do. But we're continually going after the Muslims, you know, and continually being, you know, this is a threat and this is the threat. And if it's not, you know, gels and stuff like that, then it's, you know, it's just too bad. But
right.
For those of us that can see it, hey, you know, it's all bullshit. You know, Joe Vaninetti made this, and and it's just exactly like it was. And here is the 115. And Bob had three of these, and they came from Los Alamos. And the government stole two of them. And one of them is in a secret place in Vegas. And I thought that there was only three guys in the world that knew where it was. And reading George's stuff on ATS, he claims to know where it was, and I don't know whether he does or not. But that's the half-scale model, and I've got the drawing that Bob made to me in February of 90 of how how it worked. In other words, the 115 was bombarded with protons, and the heat through a thermionic generator provided the positive voltage to run the ship, and then the gravity A wave was drawn off so that they could use it to go travel throughout the universe